Summer car travel can have its challenges, and I'm not just talking about, the kids in the back. Are we there yet?
I have to go to the bathroom.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, man.
Open your window.
Yeah, if you've been either a driver or a passenger on a long car trip, probably had that sore neck or maybe cramped legs or just overall achiness that seems kind of par for the course sometimes. We need to think about taking care of our bodies on the way, and you're going to have a better time once you get there. So we've got once a month a couple of wonderful physical therapists share what they know and experience with us, and we're going to zero in a little bit on traveling today with Bill Boisenault, associate professor at the UW Medical School and a public health and senior physical therapist at the Spine Center Physical Therapy Clinic. Do I have that right, Bill?
Oh, that's a lot.
Got it, yes.
Well, thanks for being here.
Good to be back, as always.
And Lori Diane Brody, a physical therapist, athletic trainer with UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center. She's also the grad program director at the Rocky Mountain University of Health Professionals in Provo, Utah. Great to see you, Lori.
Good to be here. Oh, it's such a sunny summer day.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day.
It is fantastic. It is hot, though. Hot. Yes.
I want to ask you one question. It has to do with the bicycling.
Mm-hmm.
Ragbri.
Leaving Friday.
I thought you were going to be...
That's right. My oldest son, Nate, who just turned 14, and I will go do that. We leave on Friday. We start riding on Sunday. So this will be his fourth year that he's done the ride.
And for those who don't know what it is...
Register's annual great bike ride across Iowa. It's the 41st year, I think. It's the granddaddy of all cross-state long bike rides. I mean, 40-some years, started by two gentlemen who worked for the Des Moines Register who thought it'd be fun to get to know people. They'd ride their bikes across the state, and they had a couple hundred people join them, and now there's around about 15,000 people riding on any given day. It is a rolling party.
And several hundred miles over the course of a week.
Yeah. It ranges between 450 and 500 miles, depending upon the route. The route changes every year.
Well, good luck with that.
It should be nice. It'll be cooler than last year, which is good.
Well, there are things, back issues associated with bikes.
Oh, yeah. I'm far more worried about the butt issues.
450 miles,
That's a different kind of travel. But the people that we're seeing in the clinic these days are people who are sitting in the car. And boy, they think, well, I'm just sitting. I'm not doing anything. And your joints just don't like that. Your joints don't like to be in one position for a long period of time. So
what do you recommend? Get up and get out or what?
Yeah, well, hard as that is to do, because you just want to get there. The mantra I keep telling people is your vacation starts when you get in the car, not when you get to your destination, because everyone's just wants to drive and get there. Mm-hmm. They have to, whether you take along books on tape or you listen to NPR because of all the great programming they have or whatever, you have to think about your trip as a vacation. So you stop, you build in places where you can take a walk through a prairie or whatever it is that interests you. So you stop and get out and move.
Yeah. And from two perspectives, there are people who start on vacation that already have back pain and maybe some sciatica. And, a couple things to help minimize the damage from the driving itself is generally moving your car seat a little closer to the steering wheel can help. So your leg isn't out straight as it would be otherwise.
Okay.
Or if you're sitting way back, which can be a little more comfortable for some people, and basically you're doing a seated straight leg raise, then that can stretch the sciatic nerve and put more pressure on the back. It tends to pull us in a posterior pelvic tilt, so we slump more.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I tell people, just move up a little closer to the steering wheel, so when your foot is out there on the gas pedal or working toward the clutch, your knee is not fully extended. The other thing that can help, obviously, when you're on the highway is using cruise control, which, again, allows you to kind of change the distance between you and the steering wheel, and you can, again, have less knee extension. Thankfully, a lot of newer cars have lots of things you can adjust with the seat.
Right.
And, and adjusting the lumbar support and up and down, the height of the seat and the tilt of the back of the seat can help. If the lumbar support in the car doesn't quite fit your back, which it doesn't for lots of people, then bringing in a support, whether it's a rolled-up towel or a pillow, can be helpful. Just make sure it's in the small of the back, not down, you know, by your rear end.
Okay.
If it's too low, then again, it forces you into more of a slump posture or position. There are some lumbar supports that you buy off the racks in the stores that are actually too thick for some people. Some of the round supports in particular.
Yeah.
It's like having three arch supports in a shoe when you only need one. And so using something you can change, like a towel, or use some different pillows from home to find one. It should feel like there's a pair of hands holding your back up and not hard pressure against your back. So those are things to do, one, to help prevent back problems starting. But if you're already starting out with a back problem or sciatic along with it, those are things that can help to a degree. But like Lori said, for people already starting out with some back problems, you need to split the trip up as much as you can.
And, you know, here I was thinking as you were talking, probably in the last month I've been on a plane to Canada, Saskatchewan, then I was in Orlando, Florida, then I was in Tucson, Arizona, all in the last month on a plane. And I have to get up. I just like to get up and walk around a little bit on the plane. That really seems to help me.
Yeah, a lot of the way the plane seats are designed, they force you to sit on in a C curve,
right,
which again gives that posterior pelvic tilt, which allows our low backs to slump, and especially if you're sitting with your legs out straight, because you know your knees get stiff, and so you want your legs out there straight, which pulls you more into that slump sitting posture, and it could raise havoc for people. And you know, it's not just low back, you know, people with shoulder problems and luggage, whether it's your car or the airplane, you know, can raise heck with people who have shoulder problems or may cause a shoulder problem.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed. And the safety rules on the airplanes, where you have to stay seated for so long at the beginning and so long at the end, are really difficult for people. Or the short flights where they don't allow you to get up at all.
Yeah.
It can be really difficult in those cramped little poorly designed seats.
Yeah. Things to think about. Jerry and Shell Lake has a question for us. Let's go to him. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, thank you. I've got a bit of a knee problem. I've been forced at work to kneel a lot in the back of a pickup truck without a pad and without a knee pad, and then doing a lot of gardening, which is not quite as difficult. And after a few weeks, I look down and my left knee is totally swollen and there's no pain. Okay, and I touch it and it's all fatty and fleshy.
Mm-hmm.
And is that water on the knee?
You know, that's a pretty good term for it. It sounds like what we would call housemaid's knee. And that's because in front of your kneecap, there are several bursa, and those are little fluid-filled sacs that act as cushions around bony prominences and various places around your joints. And for people who kneel a lot, and we see this in athletes, particularly in wrestlers, because they're on their knees a lot, on the wrestling mat, they can get swelling in that bursa. It'll be like a little, like a water balloon on the front of your knee, all swollen, but it doesn't really hurt. So you could try, well, first of all, if you're kneeling in the back of a pickup without any kind of cushion, you really should figure out a way to cushion. You know, if you can't put a cushion that you kneel on because of the kind of work you do, there are knee pads that you can wear. And I don't know if it's too awkward to take them on and off or whatever, but figuring out a way to do that would be useful. Wearing a knee sleeve and putting some ice and compression on that when it's possible, either during the day or in the evening, will help with that swelling. You shouldn't wear a knee sleeve or any compression at night when you're sleeping. The compression should come off. You know, as a last resort, they can drain these, but they really don't like to because of the risk of infection. In that area, and particularly if you're gardening and doing a kind of work where you're climbing around in the back of a pickup, you would be at a higher risk for an infection. So that would be the last resort, is getting rid of it. But it'll take some time for it to go down.
Mm-hmm.
So if you leave it alone, it just might, huh?
It just might, unless you continue to aggravate it by crawling around on your knees. Then it probably won't go away. Then it will not go away.
Good luck, Jerry. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. You know, these little knee things that basketball players wear and stuff on their knees. That would be something he could probably use in a work
situation. You mean like a pull-on sleeve? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little padded pull-on sleeve, like you were talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, a little opening for the kneecap.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
John in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. I was wondering about these plastic sleeves that you fit over your legs. I think they use them in hospitals a lot, where they expand and contract using an air pump.
Yeah.
Are those useful for home use?
Well, yes. For what purpose?
Well, you know, just to keep the blood flow going, I guess. I'm not sure I would need it, but I was thinking of some of my older relatives, maybe.
They're typically used to, there are a couple different versions. One is I thought about them for Jerry because it's an intermittent compression unit where there's compression and then it releases. So we use them post-operatively on joints, and we have some that also include a cold aspect. So you can have cold with compression to help with post-operative swelling. There are also compression units that just compress and relax to prevent blood clots postoperatively, and that's probably more what you're thinking of. So would it work to prevent blood clots? Yes, that's what they're designed for. To improve circulation, it would be individual specific, and it's something that should be cleared with that person's physician before I would try it.
Mm-hmm. A diabetic person?
Well, I'm not sure about a diabetic person and their ability to feel, and then you also have to be, you would need to know their medical history before I would put it on anyone. Yeah. I would clear it with their physician before I would do that.
Yeah. Things like that external support, this pneumatic sleeve, I mean, it certainly has benefits for certain people, but it can also cause problems if it's used inappropriately. And, you know, unless somebody is paralyzed, people are relatively immobile, just, you know, doing ankle circles and tighten the knees, isometric knee contraction, get some muscle activity, also can help with venous return and may help with some swelling. So ideally, you know, if someone needs a pneumatic sleeve, you combine that with activity, whatever they can tolerate and they can do, then you're going to have better results.
Thanks a lot for calling, John. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Talking with Lori Tan Brody and Bill Boisenault about avoiding injury things to do once you have an injury to make yourself better. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Bill Boisenault and Lori Tan Brody, taking a look at physical therapy issues with them. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. Nancy in Menominee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Hi. I have a soon-to-be 16-year-old daughter, a three-sport athlete, cross-country, track, basketball. She's actually a black belt in karate. And she is so tight in her back that she literally cannot touch her toes when bending over. We have seen a physical therapist. We know that the trampoline is forbidden. It triggers it. She's just not even allowed to do any kind of thing like that. My question is, with the stretching that she has, the exercises, what can we do when she does get this pain?
Nancy, can I ask, is it back pain and leg pain, or one versus the other?
It's lower back pain.
Okay. All right. And was there an original injury? I mean, she sounds extremely active. Was there an injury that started this at some point?
No, we cannot figure it out. I mean, she's embarrassed because she does the presidential fitness and she excels, but she really just cannot. She's the tightest child that you've ever seen.
Okay. All right. And I'm assuming she's had some imaging of her low back, x-rays, or?
Yes. And she did some quite a bit of physical therapy last summer.
Okay.
Because she was in some pretty extreme pain, which the jumping on the trampoline caused.
Right.
We felt triggered.
Okay. All right. Well, a couple things. Some of us just weren't designed to do the splits. It's just the way, you know, our collagen, and it's more genetics than anything in terms of lack of flexibility. But in those cases, generally people lack flexibility everywhere, not just in their low back. So I would assume your shoulders would be a little tighter. Maybe they don't have quite the neck range of motion that someone else may have. That's one thing. Also, with adolescents and younger, sometimes growth spurts – The bone grows faster. It takes a while for the soft tissues to catch up. And so when there's been growth spurts, you know, people get tighter, and, you know, in essence, lose flexibility. And in terms of just general lack of mobility in the low back, flexibility of the hips then is critical. You try to compensate for what the back can't do for more flexibility through the hips. And it's not just hamstring. I'm assuming she's having – you mentioned touching toes. I've seen a number of people that have been stretching their hamstrings like crazy, and they still don't have the extensibility that they want to have or need to have. And so there are one-joint muscles around the hip, back in the buttock area as well as kind of inside and outside the hip, that are stretched differently than hamstrings are. And there's times you can gain quite a bit of flexibility by actually working other muscle groups than the hamstrings. So I'm assuming that she's been stretching muscles other than her hamstrings. Is that a correct assumption?
Well, I'm hoping so. She actually, with the physical therapy, it was the hips that she was they were very more concerned. She has even though she's a runner, she has an extremely painful to watch gait.
Mm-hmm.
She always has from child on. So the hips are some of the things that she is supposed to be exercising. Whether or not she does them is another question all the time.
Okay.
She is weightlifting through school this summer. I'm just wondering, when she does get the pain in the lower back, we've been trying to have her ice it. And actually try to put her on some Aleve. Is that something we can continue to do? And she does work through it. She's a very tolerant child, and she will work through it, the pain. But, you know, I don't want to push her. I'm just worried that if at age 16 she is got back problems, what will the future bring?
Right. No, those are good thoughts. You know, the things you've been using in the past, the ice certainly is appropriate, and the Aleve, you have to be careful how much she's taking. And, you know, maybe just if she's working with a sports medicine physician or has a primary care physician, make sure that she doesn't have any stomach problems or isn't at risk for kidney problems. So, you know, Aleve, anybody can buy over the counter, but it certainly can be overdone, overused. So, you know, if she's using it, you know, on a daily basis and it sounds like the dose is increasing, then I would just, you know, stay in touch with her primary care physician.
Nancy, is she a swimmer at all?
She is not a religious swimmer, no.
But
we don't. She enjoys swimming, but it isn't something that we get her in the pool a lot.
Okay. Because swimming would be a good alternative activity for her. It requires sort of lengthening and stretching from the, you know, the tips of her fingers through her toes, and you get some nice rotation. If she can do a flip turn, you get nice flexibility through the hips and low back. That's all. The pool's also a really nice place to stretch. Many times people can be more successful with their stretching in the pool in the unweighted environment than they are on land. It's more comfortable and it's easier. So if she could do a little bit of swimming or even deep water running where she gets some good mobility without the weight bearing and then some stretching, that might be useful too.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Mary in Appleton is next. So let's go there to Mary. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having this program. I have had, well, from a kid on, I could never sit cross-legged like everybody else. My right hip would not allow my leg to go down at all. But I have had back trouble, lower back trouble, for many years. I have some IT issues with the right leg and severe cramping at night. But to get in a car just sends me up a wall. I sit on a hard board rather than on a soft seat. I have multiple cushions that I place in various areas, and my carry-on for the airport is basically cushions to get things situated. I don't know if the right IT band is a problem, but the lower left has also been causing trouble. Is there any exercises, or I've gone to an osteopath. He has made some adjustments, which have helped, but as soon as things tighten up again, I'm right back where I was.
So, Mary, it sounds like you're having problems more than just getting in and out of the car. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Yeah, right. And we do a lot of car travel. And, yes, sitting in the car is just it's kind of torture. And we do stop often. My husband's very good about that.
Okay. All right. Well, you mentioned your IT band, your iliotibial band, which, among other hip muscles, certainly can influence the position of the pelvis and the low back. And so it depends on how extensive these iliotibial band problems are for you. But there are exercises to help treat iliotibial band syndrome. And it relates to some core strengthening, addressing muscle imbalances around the hip. People use foam rollers or tennis balls to work knots out of the iliotibial band to get the muscle to relax and lengthen some. So is there a connection? It's possible that there's a connection.
Yes. And I have a foam roller.
Mm-hmm.
How often should I be using it? It's very painful, but I mean, I don't mind if I can actually work through this, or is this just something for the rest of my life?
Yeah, well, you can overdo it, or how much you should do it. You can do it a couple times a day, and it is if you need it, it is painful. You can kind of control how much body weight you're allowing onto the foam roller, so you should be able to breathe as you're doing the kneading of the musculature, and then it's good to follow that with elongation of the iliotibial band or a stretch, and that may help those knots from just coming back again.
Okay, and how long generally do you do the foam roller? I mean, like 5 minutes?
Until you cry.
Until you cry, okay.
Which could be 10 seconds or 10 minutes.
No, but doing it for, 3 to 5 minutes if you can, and if you need to take a break in between. But, that connective tissue takes a while to work and to loosen. It creates some heat that kind of breaks and loosens some of those bonds and that thick connective tissue. So it takes a while, particularly if you want to get long-term results from it. So,
should I ice after?
I don't know that it makes a great deal of difference. You could try icing and see if it makes a difference for you, but it's not going to be the same for everybody.
Yeah.
So as Bill said, it should be at a level that's you're able to tolerate for a length of time.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much. And to me, I think the new cars with all their curvatures in the seats are just absolutely maddening.
Yes. Getting the right position.
It's a double-edged sword.
Getting to the point to fit you, it can be very challenging. And even when you find the sweet spot for all the settings, when you're in the car for more than 45 minutes to an hour, you should adjust them a little bit just to change the pressure points and the angle that you're sitting at. But yes, it can be maddening.
Thanks, Mary, for calling. Melissa sent us a Facebook message and says, I broke both my elbows, ouch, last September, and wondering if upper forearm pain and hand pain are normal this far from the dates of my injury. I've been told to deal with it and wondering your opinion. So it was last September. How do you break both elbows?
Well, that's the real question. So is, forearm and hand pain? Well, how did you break both your elbows is the question. So if you had, we call it a foosh injury, fall on an outstretched hand. She fell on an outstretched hand and that's how her elbows were fractured, then she's probably going to have some hand pain, and the force would be transmitted down her forearm bones to her elbows, and she could have some pain from that too. So the bottom line is the mechanism of injury that resulted in both elbows being fractured could certainly have damaged her upper forearms and her hands at the same time. And then depending upon how it was treated, was it surgically fixated? Are there bony plates and screws in there? Was she immobilized and it treated conservatively until the fracture sealed? Then she's going to have some pain from being immobilized for that long. So it certainly can be normal, but if you're having a lot of pain, it should be addressed. Yeah. So at this point, it's not going to just go away on its own. There's something in either the original injury that wasn't addressed or subsequent treatment that wasn't addressed that's perpetuating her symptoms.
Yeah, if she hasn't had rehabilitation, even at this stage, that if she's been told to deal with it, the hope has been that everything has been tried, including a good rehabilitation program. If she hasn't seen a physical therapist, especially even in the last few months, then a visit or two, at least the therapist can tell her, is there anything that can be done from what PT can offer?
Mm-hmm. We had earlier a caller who was a lot of time on truck beds on his knees and, you know, having some kind of water on the knee issues. Joe emailed us from Washburn. I just want to mention a simple knee protective solution that I wear almost every day. Soft Knees makes pads that insert into double knee work pants. This eliminates the uncomfortable strap that most pads employ behind the knee, causing a bind. And once in place, you don't know they're there, and they can be washed without removing from the work pants. They're always in the right place when kneeling is required. I also wear them for some added protection while riding my motorcycle. Doesn't that sound like a great...
I should have invented them myself.
Right.
Yeah, that's a great solution.
Thank you. Thank you for that information, Joe.
Yeah, that was wonderful.
Love it.
Soft Knees.
Soft Knees.
Heidi in Janesville, it's your turn. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, what's on your mind?
A year ago, I started having some kind of funny numbness in my right wrist down below my thumb. And I was like, oh, okay, that's unusual. But, and then it slowly started to hurt, and then it became extremely painful. And then I thought, okay, now maybe I should go to the doctor. So I did, and he did an ultrasound on it and diagnosed it as tendonitis and gave me a shot of cortisone. And the next day it was better. And then 2 days later, it was like 95% better. And I thought, oh, great, this is awesome. Okay, I'm all fixed. And then 2 months later, the pain started slowly coming back. I'm like, oh, no. So I went, thought, oh, I'll get another cortisone shot. And the orthopedic surgeon said, no.
No.
That they really, really try not to do it more than once, twice at the absolute extreme. But so then I did physical therapy for about 6 weeks. That helped somewhat, where they would do some electrical thing over it, and then they put this electrical bandage thing on there, and that worked pretty well. And I would do my exercises religiously, and it just isn't better. So then I went back to the doctor, and at this point he said, you know, it's up to me to decide, but the next step would be surgery. And to, I don't know, cut the tendon or release it or something. Do you see that often, and do you see much success with it?
So which tendon is he talking about, and do you have any idea what started this off?
I have no idea what started it. It just slowly came on. It wasn't like I fell. I didn't hit something. I didn't bump anything. It just slowly got worse and worse and worse. So I don't know. And
this is your dominant hand?
Yes.
Okay. And what kind of work do you do?
Well, I do. I really only work a couple hours a day for our business.
Okay.
I do computer work, but I don't sit there all day with a mouse and type. Maybe a couple hours a day. And that's it. I do drive probably a couple hours a day. But other than that, not much. So
how debilitating is this for you?
Okay, during the day, for the most part, it's just kind of irritating. It's at night when it's extremely, not debilitating, it's like it wakes me up a couple times during the night, and I'm starting to think, is it something I can live with, or do I want to take that jump and have surgery, and then what if it gets worse, you know? I'm not sure. Like, I take one Advil and one Tylenol together once a day. And I don't know if you're supposed to do that, but that helps immensely.
Okay.
All right.
Do you, did you see a hand specialist when you went to therapy? Or?
No. She was, I think, occupational.
All right.
Therapist.
And did they talk at all about splints for you at night?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And sometimes I do wear a splint at night. If it's a good day and it's not hurting so bad, I don't. But, yeah, I do wear one periodically at night, but not every night.
And does that help?
Sort of.
Okay.
It helps me from accidentally moving in the middle of the night while I'm sleeping, where I will push against the bed or something, and it wakes me up because it hurts. So.
Okay. Well, what you really end up deciding is how much better you could be with surgery, and that's a conversation to have with the surgeon, mm-hmm. And what the prognosis is with this kind of surgery. And then deciding mm-hmm. how much you have to gain and what the risk of the downfall is. Mm-hmm. So the idea would be to live with it, you know, as long as you can. And the question is why it came back after you had the cortisone injection, because typically something like this wouldn't show up and flare without some other kind of underlying cause.
I think I know, because I made the mistake of I was exercising and I incorporated weights into my exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
So I was doing not real heavy weightlifting and dumbbells and things like that. And I just wonder if that is what started it up again, and I mm-hmm. probably shouldn't have done that.
Yep. Yeah, that could be. That could mm-hmm. be. And which tells you that it can get better without surgery. It did once before.
Mm-hmm.
You may want to hang out a while longer, do what you can do, and then go back. And after a year, you may be eligible to have another cortisone injection. And then if you don't go back to that same weight program, you might be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I'd almost rather try that than surgery before. So
agreed. Yep.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody, our guests today, UW physical therapists. Great to have them along. Thank you so much for listening in. Helen and Madison, you're up next for your question. Hello.
Yes, I have a question in regard to a pain that I get in my upper leg on the back, and then it goes all the way down to my foot. At times, I have noticed this pain from the leg down to the knee when I sit on a certain chair, and then I have to get up and move because that hurts. Now, the pain also is partially in my knee.
Okay,
now,
okay.
I don't know if it makes any difference, but I am old. I'm 92.
Oh, that's not old.
No, that's great.
And I do take Tylenol. I take about 5 Tylenol a day.
Okay. Helen, do you ever get this pain any other time besides sitting?
Yes. Just recently, within the last week, it started to be when I would walk.
Okay.
Especially when I first get up in the morning.
Okay. All right. And the pain, and it does go below your knee into the foot?
Yes.
Any numbness or tingling with this?
Not numbness or tingling, no.
Okay. And any weakness in the last couple of weeks? Tripping over your toes or trouble with stairs or anything like that?
No.
Out of the ordinary for you?
I don't believe so. I do use a cane with most walking other than in my home.
Okay. All right. And so it sounds like it's gotten a little worse in the last week or two. How long have you had this pain?
Well, this one, when I would sit in a chair, has probably been a couple of years, but it was something that only happened then, so I didn't think any more about it.
Okay, right, of course. Well, a couple options for you. You can see a physical therapist. Most likely this is coming from your back or maybe combined with your hip. And there may be some exercises they could recommend to you, maybe some recommendations for seating posture that would not only help get rid of this but help keep this from coming back again for you. The fact that you're also having it now with walking now tells me whatever's in there is getting worse or it's changing. And, you know, if it starts interfering with walking to a degree, it can impact your balance, then it could cause major problems. Mm-hmm. And that's why it may be worth being seen. And again, within a couple of visits, a physical therapist can tell you to what degree they can help you and what they can recommend. The fact you're not having any numbness or tingling, you're not noticing any weakness is a really good thing. Generally, when pain goes below the knee, oftentimes it's nerve-related. But we get more concerned when there's frank weakness or you've got some numbness along with it. But you don't want it to get to that stage either. So if you can get in to see a physical therapist, give your physician a call about a referral, and if you can get in to see a physical therapist, if you're homebound, then they can set up a home health visit for you. where a therapist can come in and examine you and develop a program for you in your home.
Well, I'm not homebound.
Okay.
And I have had physical therapy over the years, 3 or 4 different times for my back.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, things have changed now. So, you know, the things you were doing before may be appropriate now, or they may need to be changed because your symptoms are different now than they were previously.
Yeah. Ellen, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault, our guests today. Lots more to talk about with them. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network as we talk aches and pains and sprains and strains with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault, UW physical therapists. Great to have them along. We've got a Facebook comment or question from Bob, who wondered if we could repeat information about the specialized bicycle fitting that you guys mentioned last month at the UW-Madison. There's someone who does this, apparently.
Yeah, there's staff at the Physical Therapy Sports Medicine Clinic at the Research Park facility. So there are a couple different staff members there who will take your bike and put it up on a trainer and have you get on it and pedal away, and they will examine your posture, make some changes, adjustments, recommendations, and so on. The number there, I believe, is 263-4765.
263-4765. Okay, there we go. We have Andy in Dale, Wisconsin, up next. Hi, Andy. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Okay. I think it's a sprained large toe. I was going with my grandchildren on sand dunes on last week, and then I didn't really notice any symptoms. However, about 2 days later, we went for long walks in Chicago, and my foot started hurting, but there was nothing I could do about it because we were kind of far away to rest. And so I just kept walking, and it got very, very sore. I'm just wondering if it's like a sprained toe or something from walking on the soft sand. And if so, what should I do besides just icing it?
Oh, what a good question. First thing is, have you had this kind of symptom before or any other joints?
About 8 months ago, I had a gout in my other foot.
Okay.
But it doesn't look the same. The pain seems to be mostly between my index, what you'd consider your index toe and your large toe.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be right in that area and on that joint, but not on the outside of the large toe.
Okay. Well, because that gout was my first thought, because that's the joint that tends to get to react most when you have gout. So I think the first thing would be ruling that out.
Okay.
I doubt if it was sprained. The next thing on the differential list would be a flare of some osteoarthritis.
Okay.
That's a joint that is known to be susceptible to osteoarthritis. The question would be, if you were walking around barefoot in the sand with both feet.
Wasn't barefoot.
Okay.
I was wearing shoes.
Okay. Well, in any case, both feet were doing the same thing. So the question is, why are you having symptoms in one foot and not the other? So I think, you know, getting in to see somebody, whether you start with your primary care and deal with it as a possible gout, or physical therapist to look at your mechanics and your feet and try to determine why you're having problems on one side and not the other, if there's some underlying cause so this doesn't come back and happen again, would be important. But yeah, you should be seen for this.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
All right.
Thanks a lot for
calling.
Thanks,
Andy.
And Alan Land O'Lakes, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Bless you guys for doing this show, because I always try and learn more about my problems. I'm 65. I have severe DJD. I've had my knees replaced and have been getting epidural injections for many years now. But my question is actually two parts. I get epidurals that are effective in L5-S1 and the SI joints. And I've heard about fibrin. I wonder if you had any information about that, like where it might be available. I used to be 6'4", now I'm just over 6 feet. And then in the neck, I've had facet and epidural injections in the neck, which had no effect whatsoever. So now they're talking about surgery where they go in from the front of the neck and put a staple in. And, you know, I'd love to advance as far as dealing with this stuff so, you know, like I could sit in the boat again. I could sit on a dock, but sitting in the boat doesn't work too good anymore. Anyway, okay. I'll hang up and let you talk.
So, well, before you do that, the fibrin, what was the purpose of that? Is that to stabilize or fuse your SI joint?
Right, and actually the show I saw, which was on public television, this actually raises you up to as much as your original height, and it goes in the disc, and it's a two-part or binary solution that replaces the material between your discs. And I guess the FDA approved this stuff, but, you know, it's I went on the Internet, and I just get the pharmacology of it, which I don't even know what that means, but it's hard to get any further information on it because the people that they had on the show just raved about it. They were pain-free, and they gained their height back and that kind of deal.
Well, do you know anyone in your area who's doing the surgery would be the first question. And
no,
then,
and I ask. Yeah. I go to Marshfield Clinic, and they, you know, for my epidurals, and they've never heard of it either.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be the first thing is figuring out if someone's doing it. And if it's relatively new, there's not going to be any information on long-term outcomes. And, you know, certainly when they're discussing this, they're going to bring on the people who had successful outcomes. So
right.
You don't know what the downside is until there's more information.
Right. Yeah, you know, I'm certainly not aware of everything out there that's being developed, but I'm not aware of a material that's injectable that will change height like that. You know, I wonder if you were watching an infomercial that, again, it was more based on testimonials than hard science. So, again, I mean, and especially if you're talking to the local experts and they haven't heard of it, I would assume that they would be up in the literature as well. In terms of your question about the neck and going in from the front, it's like they're discussing doing a fusion where they go in from the front and they use hardware they use that to separate the vertebra, give a little more space. And infuse the vertebrae together so you eliminate motion, and that can eliminate some pain. You need to talk with the surgeon about prognosis. If you have degenerative joint disease at multiple levels in the cervical spine, if they only fuse one, the other adjacent areas can break down fairly quickly. And the more levels they fuse, generally the poorer the outcome. So, you know, really trying to get some hard numbers regarding how many levels are they thinking of fusing and what is the long-term expectation for things like fishing and anything else that you like to do. The boat can be a tough place. You know, the bouncing as you go through the water and the seated position tends to be fairly low, and it puts a lot of pressure in the back. More so for your low back, indirectly for your neck, one of the things that I've had some success with people getting is called a back sling chair or a NADA chair, N-A-D-A. And it's a pad that fits in your low back, and there's two straps or loops that go around your knees. And then you can tighten or loosen the loops to give your low back more or less support. I've had a lot of people use that when they backpack and camp, and people who love to do canoeing can give some pretty good low back support when you don't have a back support related to the seats in the boat. And so you can Google back sling chair or NADA chair, again, N-A-D-A, and take a look and see if there might be something that could be useful, could be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Wayne in Ashwaubenon, excuse me. Get that pronouncing right. Hi, Wayne. Thank you for calling.
thanks. I think I've got plantar fasciitis. I think that's what it's called.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My feet hurt something awful when I first get up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the day goes by, the more you walk, the better it feels. But it still hurts a lot.
Oh,
what
yeah.
What can I do? What can I do for it?
Well, how long have you had it, and do you know what brought it on?
Well, I think what brought it on was I was cutting the grass the other day, and I didn't have an insert in my shoe.
Oh, okay.
And it just hasn't gotten better since then.
Okay. Well, the quick short-term things, massage, like rolling a tennis ball underneath your feet to kind of massage that plantar fascia, making sure you're wearing your inserts, icing, making an ice cup in your freezer, tearing the top off and ice massaging it throughout the day, and okay. A night splint at night. Probably the night splint is the best thing. It'd be interesting with both feet to get a night splint and swap left and right and see if one is better than the other when you wear that night splint at night the next day.
I tend not to have a problem with my right foot. It's my left foot there.
Okay. Yeah.
Hurts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah. For people who have plantar fasciitis, it tends to come and go over the years, depending upon yep. what foolish things we do. So having a night splint handy in your cabinet, I think, is a useful thing. And there's a number of different styles out there. There's the posterior splint that goes behind. There's an anterior splint that goes on the front of your foot. That's my personal favorite, but you can find something that's comfortable for you at night, and you might find that that's gives you pretty good relief. It sometimes takes a while for that to work, but it tends to be worth it. Those are the easy things, and then alternatively, you can go see someone, a physical therapist, who can examine your gait and figure out why you're having this, although it seems as though you've been down that road because you already have some inserts in your shoes.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Pat in Madison. I often have stiff neck and shoulders, and I'm bothered when I'm driving. Are there exercises or stretches I can do in advance of a long drive that would help? The stiffness is probably a result of reading in bed and tension.
Yeah, the reading in bed can get people into trouble when we're kind of lying fairly flat and have a couple pillows propped up underneath our head and neck and puts us in a posture that's not good and can bother lots of people. Sitting more upright in bed and maybe using a bed pillow, something to put the book on or magazine on to bring it closer to you, like almost like a premise, like a music stand. So then you don't have to look down so much if mm-hmm. the reading material is up closer to your eyes. But being propped up more in bed can help. In terms of stretching, ideally a semi-regular stretching program, not just before you go on a trip, but kind of it's more of the routine related to your week. There is some good stretches for the neck and shoulders, but also mid-back and upper back. A lot of muscles that attach at the head and neck also attach down across the shoulders and the upper back region. So there are some good stretches for the rib cage and that mid back that can take tension off the cervical area, some gentle range of motion. People use foam rollers. People use exercise balls or physio balls to stretch over to exercise with. And in driving, again, careful how far away you are from the steering wheel, as you mentioned before. Further away you are, that can impact shoulder posture and neck posture. And going back to what Lori said earlier, splitting up the drive. And it's not just for your low back and legs, but getting out and gently stretching your neck, hands up overhead, hands behind your back can help to a degree as well.
So you pull your arms back
Yeah, kind of pinch your shoulder blades to together. Make sure you're upright, tall, so your chin's not jutting out forward, and kind of stretching the hands back, stretching arms up overhead can be good general stretches for people. Gently turning their head to the left and to the right, gently looking up and down to the ground, doing it slowly and holding the stretch for a few counts are some good general things.
Yeah.
And for those people who think it's only because they're old, if you ever sit around at a rest stop and see kids get out of the car, their first instinct is also to stretch when they get out of the car.
Yeah.
So that's true.
People, they need to move. You sit in a car, everybody gets stiff. So it's not just the adults. And I think as a model, it's good to make those frequent stops, get out, throw a ball with your kids. If you have your kids, take a little football or a little soccer ball, kick a ball around, do a little bit of stretching and make it a play fun time.
Yeah.
And they can get in the habit of doing that also.
Well, and Lori, like you said before, the vacation starts when you start the trip is a good way to look at that. Yeah. Not driving 6 hours so we can start playing around, and I understand people want to get to their destination as quickly as possible. But, if you're not tied to a quick time frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there we go. Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne-Brody are going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We are going to take a quick look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet, and then we'll be back with Lori and Bill. Stay with us. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn hosts her weekly All Things Political show, looking at the big news stories of the week. That's today at 1 o'clock. Right now, though, visiting with Lori Tyne-Brody and Bill Boisenault. Lori, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center. Bill's associate professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and a senior physical therapist at the Spine Center Physical Therapy Clinic at the UW Hospitals and Clinics. Great to have both of them with us. Thank you so much for listening in. And you can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we'd love to hear from you. We had a Facebook comment, Lori and Bill, from Heather, saying that myofascial release has been the answer for her to address long-time issues from a fall as a child. Lower back, I think that she was responding to the mother who called about her 16-year-old daughter's lower back pain and said that myofascial really helped her. Is that the proper pronunciation, by the way?
Myofascial.
Myofascial. Okay.
Yeah. So, well, myofascial release falls in the category of manual therapy, which is one of the interventions that physical therapists use. So for people who have, very stiff connective tissues, some manual therapy certainly can help move those things along. Whether it was caused by an injury, recently or years ago, it's one of the things that a physical therapist would use. So I know that that the 16-year-old we talked about earlier had some physical therapy. I don't know if she had any manual therapy at the time, but the physical therapist would do an evaluation and determine whether or not some manual therapy would be appropriate for that individual in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Robin Montello, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi there. I had a question kind of related to the older lady that called about pain down the side of my leg.
Yes.
But mine includes not necessarily tingling, but kind of a numb, weak feeling. And it usually starts in my hip and eventually goes down to my knee and foot. And if I don't get to the chiropractor, it sometimes goes up into my the back of my shoulder and affects the muscles in the back of my shoulder, too. And I was just curious if they had any advice for, I know you were talking about the myofascial release, and I've done the activated release therapy, which focuses on specific muscle groups, and that seems to help, and so does the chiropractor. But is there a root issue that I could maybe address?
Well, it sounds like there's a nerve that's irritated and probably up in your low back area. So the question is, why isn't that nerve healing? You want to take as much tension off the nerve as possible, and that can be accomplished in a variety of ways, including modifying sitting posture, like we've talked about earlier today. If it gets worse with walking or if you're running, you want to shorten the stride length. I mean, there's lots of things you do to try to get the tension off a nerve that's been irritated. Okay. And then try to figure out, why is it happening? And that will help direct the treatment more to the nerve itself or more the low back area itself. Rob, can I ask how long you've had this?
It started about the middle of college, which was about 3-4 years ago.
Okay.
I've been pretty active. Physically, I played soccer and basketball, golf. I played soccer in college, too. And I've taken some, you know, pretty nasty falls in the past, but never had any, you know, immediate problems after that. And I've always gone, I go to the chiropractor usually once or twice a month, and it helps the symptoms of, you know, that weak feeling. But recently, I've noticed that I've started to lose strength in my right leg. I was wondering if there's anything I could do to address that other than, you know, I used to lift weights. I don't anymore. And I was thinking about getting back into that to strengthen my leg.
Yeah, the weakness bothers me more than anything else that you've mentioned, and especially if you notice some recent changes. If the weakness is due to pressure on a nerve for whatever reason, all strengthening in the world is not going to help you regain strength. The problem's not with the muscle. It's if you think of the nervous system as an electrical system, and when there's pressure on a nerve, it shuts off the electricity moving down that nerve connecting to the muscles. So, I guess I would have a talk with your chiropractor about maybe seeing a physician, maybe a spine specialist, talk about this is where an MRI may be very helpful. Try to figure out, you know, which nerve or nerves are being compromised, and if so, by what. And I guess I would have that discussion fairly soon, again, especially with the weakness that you're describing.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Don and Holman, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. I'm hoping that your guests are able to discuss a rotary cuff problem that I seem to be having for the last number of weeks. I'm not sure if I should go in and be seen. I am 70. I thought maybe that was the reason, but it just won't go away.
Is this your dominant arm?
Yes.
And did you do something? Were you out, like, chainsawing or something that brought this on a few weeks ago?
No, I tried to think of what might have caused it, and nothing seems to surface.
Okay. Well, sometimes it's just a matter of sleeping on it wrong, where you flare the bursa that sits on top of your rotator cuff, and once it gets stirred up, if it's in your dominant arm, sometimes it's hard for it to go away because you keep using it for your daily activities. I would go in, since it's been several weeks, if it was going to go away on its own. You are correct, it would have. So it seems like you need a little bit of help to move it along, and some specific exercises to strengthen your rotator cuff and some of the other muscles in your shoulder girdle that support your rotator cuff can help move this along more quickly. So, yeah, I'd go in and have the scene and get yourself on the right track before months and months go by and you start losing motion and function in that arm.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks, Don, for calling. And Larry in La Crosse, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Say, I'm wondering if your guests haven't heard of something that was mentioned to me, not more than about a few years ago. I've had numerous incidents or accidents and then some surgeries as well. But recently I had a surgery where I had quite a bit of swelling that wouldn't subside. So the surgeon told me to go hot and cold and hot and cold again for approximately 20 minutes at a time. And that actually did alleviate the swelling, and it brought the pain down. The same thing I was told for tissue that the blood doesn't flow through, but yet flows around. To do that same method, cartilage, if you will. To help that cartilage in its mending process. since no blood actually flows through it to help mend it or to reduce the swelling and the pain and come at it this direction with hot and cold. I've always heard of just using cold.
Well, it's the simplest and most straightforward, but alternating hot and cold, we call them contrast baths. It's a pretty tried and true technique. We use it most often for extremities, ankle sprains, or hand things because it's easier to stick your hand or your ankle in a bucket of warm water followed by an ice slush. Typically, we do 3 minutes warm, 1 minute cold, and alternate those for, as you said, 15 to 20 minutes. And that works nicely to help move some swelling out. It's not as convenient or easy to do on other body parts because you kind of got to fuss with hot packs and cold packs and things like that. And frankly, other parts of your body where you have more subcutaneous tissue, the heat and cold really don't penetrate deep enough to have an impact on those deeper tissues. So it works better for hands, feet, ankles, things like that. But you're absolutely right. It's a very good technique for reducing swelling. Absolutely.
Yeah. And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Larry. Robin in Madison, your turn. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am in my early 50s, and I have been told that I need a full hip replacement on my right hip due to dysplasia, bone on bone, no, like 80% of my cartilage is gone, labrum gone. Very active. I danced for years. I've done yoga for years, and I can't do any of those things right now with my hip the way it is. My question is, what is the difference between hip resurfacing versus the replacement? I mean, I know surgically what the difference is. How do I know what I'm a candidate for, either the resurface or the replacement?
Ask your surgeon. I mean, really, yeah. With hip dysplasia, you're probably going to need a replacement because you're going to need both components. So a resurfacing is where they would typically resurface the femoral head. A replacement is they would remove the head, put in a new ball and a new socket. And chances are, if you have dysplasia, the socket side of it is no longer rounded or congruent with the ball. And so even if they went and they resurfaced the ball, it would not fit congruently with the socket. So
with the
you
acetabulum.
The acetabulum, yes. I was trying to use the generic term. But yes, the acetabulum. So you would need both so that you could have that congruent fit.
Right. Okay. And do you guys have any on components? I mean, there's so much controversy over different components. Is there anything you've seen in your practice where you think these are really good components to make sure your doctor is using?
You know, I would go with a reputable surgeon, and if you have, and I would want to use what that surgeon recommended and get a second opinion.
Right.
I would get a second opinion from someone in a different practice, not somebody at the same practice, because they'll have similar opinions typically. And that way you can get the pros and cons of both those. But typically these surgeries go pretty well and people tend to have good outcomes following hip replacements.
And as far as the outcome, will I get back to full functioning, sitting cross-legged on the floor, doing pigeon pose? I mean, all the things I used to be able to do. Will a hip replacement get me back to complete full functioning?
Probably not your level of function as you're defining it would be my guess, giving your yoga and dance background. Mm-hmm. If you were me, you know, who likes to swim and bike and stuff like that, it would get me back to full functioning. But I'm not sure it's going to get you back as you have expectations in your mind. So I would voice those expectations with my surgeon so that you can get a realistic read on it, because you'll be very disappointed if you're, even if it is a good outcome as the surgeon would define it, if it doesn't meet your expectations. So having realistic expectations ahead of time, you are correct, is spot on.
Okay. Mm-hmm. One other question if you have time. The first surgeon I saw when I mentioned physical therapy after the surgery, post-surgery, he said, oh, well, you'll need a PT in the hospital. That's all you need. Then we send you home. And to me, that just feels really, like, crazy. Like, don't I need physical therapy after?
Very good question, Robin. And there are many surgeons who never send their patients for physical therapy afterwards. We do for knee replacements because those people tend to have a lot of difficulty getting back. As I said earlier, hip replacements, that's a pretty darn good surgery. However, that being said, your activity level and your expectations are very different from your typical patient who's undergoing a hip replacement, who would be an older, more sedentary individual who is going just for pain relief. You have a pain relief and you have a higher function and longer to live with that hip. So I would say that you absolutely need some physical therapy. And if your surgeon is being resistant about that, even after you voice what is a reasonable expectation, then you might consider that that wouldn't be a good fit for you.
Yeah.
In terms of having your hip done with that person.
There you go.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. We have open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. But an email from Kristen. A recent x-ray shows that I have a heel spur on my left foot. I'm going to a podiatrist this week, but would appreciate if you can explain this painful thing and tell me what this means long term. I'm a recreational runner, like to exercise in lots of different ways. I'm worried about limitations that this might impose.
Well, this is kind of in line with Wayne's call earlier about plantar fasciitis. So my guess is that Kristen was having some heel or foot pain, and that's what took her into the medical system where she obtained a radiograph where they found the heel spur. So the heel spur is typically not the cause of the pain. The heel spur is evidence that you have excessive pressure and strain on your plantar fascia. So removing the heel spur, and they don't do that very often anymore, fortunately, but removing the heel spur does not get rid of your pain because it's not the source of the pain. It's the plantar fasciitis that's the source of the pain. So typically, we would treat this as we treat any other plantar fasciitis. In fact, I've had a heel spur for probably 25 years, and I mean, I don't know if it's gone away or not. I don't have a re-x-ray, but occasionally the plantar fascia flares, and I do my massage and ice and night splint and my stretching and change my orthotics, and then it goes away. Then it goes away. So she should be able to continue. But again, the question is, why are you having symptoms on one side and not the other? If you haven't been examined to see if there's some sort of imbalance, leg length difference, if there's something about your running mechanics or where you're running that's contributing to that, then that would be the answer, because treating the symptoms will only be a temporary relief if you go back to whatever the underlying cause was of the original problem.
Jeannie in Salem, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to offer encouragement to the gal who called in before, because my husband had the hip replacement for dysplasia 5 years ago, and he does very awkward positions at work and can do absolutely everything, and went back to work a month after surgery. And what her surgeon may have been saying was that she would only meet with a PT at the hospital, but his PT came directly to the home the day after he was discharged. And I think it was only 2 days after surgery, and it's been a wonderful outcome. He went through UW-Madison, and we are so grateful. So I just wanted to encourage her that, yeah, at her age, she probably will be able to do what she wants, and if she talks to her surgeon and works with her PT team, she'll be very happy, I think.
Well, thanks for that. I'm sure
nice.
That was much appreciated.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jeannie.
Kay in Superior. Hi.
Hi. I had a right knee replacement about 8.5 months ago, and now it's been a long time, over a year, that my left knee has hurt as well. And I have the 5 shots, the hyaluronic acid, and it still hurts on the inside of my left knee. And I don't know what to do, if I should go back to PT. I don't know.
Well, so obviously you've been in the medical system if you've gone through the shots. What did the physician say about the status of that knee and your arthritis and so on?
He just said, well, he's separate from the surgeon. He just does evaluations and shots. And he said, oh, you can come back and have the shots another 6 months or between now and then you want a cortisone shot. But I don't want a cortisone shot, and I want something more. But the whole process of that right knee took a long time, and it's still not totally done. It's still a little warm and a little swollen. But I don't know. I want to keep active. I'm 71, and I don't know how to proceed. If I should go to PT, if I should try to do it.
Well, have you been to PT?
Oh, but not lately. Not for the last month or two.
All right. Well, you can go back and get reevaluated. A pool is an ideal place for someone in your situation to work and exercise and stay active.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what it's like to go through the knee replacement. So really, after the hyaluronic acid and cortisone injections, you're really looking at a knee replacement as your next medical intervention. So, you know, you can kind of decide how much the pain is getting to you. But going back to physical therapy and seeing if they have anything else to offer and considering a water exercise program as a way to stay active would be useful.
Okay. I was wondering about a rheumatologist, but I know there's arthritis there, but I don't know which step. But it sounds like the PT is the place.
Yeah. Yeah.
For now.
Yeah.
All right. I thank you.
You
all
betcha.
Right.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We had caller Joe saying that for the earlier caller who is suffering from height loss, be sure to be screened for osteoporosis.
Yeah, I heard that caller talked about losing potentially 4 inches, maybe, or five inches, and we can lose height with osteoporosis. You have fractures of the vertebral bodies, and can decrease overall height. My assumption is, with him mentioning the low back and neck, and he had had imaging, that would have been detected. But people do lose height when you have compression fractures associated with osteoporosis.
And Lynn emailed, and her father, who was 88, was admitted to the hospital for acute sciatica yesterday morning. He woke up with extreme pain, into the hospital, drugs with it. The pain's greatly diminished. In good shape otherwise, and has a, you know, pretty healthy. What might cause this sort of sudden debilitating pain? Any ideas?
Well, that's going to be the mystery. When I hear that from patients, I try to talk, all right, so what'd you do the day before or a couple of days before? Sometimes there's activities during the day that you can't make an obvious connection with, but it could set somebody up for waking up with symptoms like this. So if there's anything your father did unusual, that's what I would think the physical therapist will help explore. It's not like he's getting better, and he will continue to get better, but why did this start in the first place?
Okay.
So there's not always an injury or an accident that you would expect, as bad as that can hurt.
Yeah. Well, here we are out of time. You guys will be back next month.
Excellent.
Third Monday of every
month.
Excellent.
We'll be
here. Yes, we will. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Bill Boisenau, Associate Professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer with the UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center. It's always great to have them here. Look forward to their visit every single month. Just looking ahead tomorrow, it's the 50th anniversary of newborn screening as a diagnostic tool. And we'll find out at 11 why that's so critical. Then at 11:45, we'll talk about getting your kids moving instead of sitting in front of a computer screen. Stay with us. Lots in store.